Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. All right, everybody, welcome to the podcast. We're recording here from New York City. It's a beautiful day, and we're here to talk about the five things that you should do.
Yeah, the five things that you should do as a children's attorney. We're gonna be talking about fundamentals here, not practical practice tips. Those we'll cover those in another podcast. But these are really the five things you need to do before you start your career. Even you should know these things. These are things we've learned the hard way over the years, and I just think if you can focus on these and you know about these ahead of time, you'll be ahead of the game. So let's start off. Number five. Figure out what they love to do and make it possible for them to do it. Okay, so you're going to hear us say a lot, probably, that talk therapy doesn't do a whole lot for kids. And that's a general statement. But you know, we've heard this from actually judges and magistrates and a lot of people in the profession. There's some guys at the University of Western Michigan in Kalamazoo. There is a university there that does amazing work on the treatment of trauma for kids in care, for foster kids. And what they propound is that if you get a kid involved in something that is self-esteem building, some activity that they love, then what happens there is it insulates them from that trauma. If you think of the trauma as like a live wire going off in the body, right? The self-esteem you get from doing something you're good at, whether it's horseback riding or dance or painting or poetry, that people say, hey, you're good at that. And then you move to the next level of that activity and you're getting better and better. That's creating self-esteem. And that actually insulates you and kind of wraps a piece of black electrical tape, if you think about it, around that live wire in your body. It insulates you from the effects of the trauma. And that is a very powerful thing. And we have seen it at work with a lot of kids over the years.
You know, we talk about safety and child welfare. We talk about permanency. And the third prong is like what you're talking about, well-being. And if you're sitting as a child's attorney, you're thinking, how is this my problem? You know, what the kid's hobby is, right? But this kid is traumatized, but how that presents itself is they're sad. They won't communicate. You can't build a rapport with them. They can't do well in school. They can't function.
They have ADHD diagnosis or
they're
on, PTSD
yeah, they're on medications.
Diagnosis.
We had a client who, she was, you know, a big sized girl. She was ostracized in school because of it. She was sad. She was on diabetic medication. Her health was failing. She was sad from the secondary trauma of being in foster care. What we found is that she loved basketball and she was built for it. And it turned her life around. It got her off the diabetic medications. It got her off the psychotropic meds because it lifted the depression. And we've seen that time and time again with kids.
So that's number five.
All right, Jim, you want to give us number four?
Yeah, number four. Treat the parents, as hard as this is sometimes, treat the parents with respect, even if you don't respect them all that much. And you can see children's attorneys digging in their heels because we are the saviors, we're the good guys. And the problem there is when you're disrespecting someone's parent, you're treading on some sacred ground. And think about your relationship with your partner or your spouse. You know, it's not okay sometimes for someone to criticize your parent, right? I mean,
if you know it's true, right?
Even if you know it's true, you know something about your parent. But the first time you hear your spouse or your boyfriend, girlfriend say, you know, your mom is a piece of work. Well, you know, you've known for years she's a piece of work, but to hear it out of someone else's mouth hurts and you don't like it. And so here are these kids that we represent coming into this system, and everyone's going to tell them how bad their parents are. All they're going to hear about from their therapists, their guardians, their foster parents is how bad their parents are. And it is counterproductive to building a relationship, and it is knocking down your client's self-esteem because their self-esteem is tied to that identity of that parent. So you've got to be able to be compassionate with the parents. You've got to be able to see the system, see the experience from the child's perspective.
This is where you got to change your mindset a little bit. I think you got to look at the kid and you got to go, well, okay, well, you know, most of them are a healthy weight. Okay, someone fed them. You know, was it perfect? No. You know, someone changed their diapers. You know, they're 6 years old and they're potty trained. Hey, someone potty trained them, okay? And if you ever potty trained a kid, it takes some effort, even if you don't do it well or on time, or, you know, and the kid doesn't have any other frame of reference, right? So we've got to look at they see that glass is half full, and I think treating their parents with respect gets you a lot of credibility out the gate with your clients.
Well, not to mention they may be going back there, you know, and at least in most cases, that's the first, I mean, that's what we try to do. And so if you come out of the gate with this negative bias and the kid knows you have that, then how are they going to trust that you're actually trying to get them home?
Right.
I think it's a credibility issue with your client as well. All right, John, you want to give us number three?
Yes. Okay, so this is important. This is number three. Explain to them that they are responding in a sane manner to an insane childhood. I had a client once, and she was at a psychiatric hospital, and I went to see her, and she really didn't want to go. And, you know, I actually helped fight against it. I didn't prevail. But it was one of those teenage girls that's on the streets a lot. And, you know, the reality is, at least in the area I practice in, is that the teenage girls will get locked up in psychiatric hospitals to keep them from, you know, having sex and running the streets. And so they're treated as conduct disorders, and they give them a diagnosis of PTSD and can't find a place to keep them safe and lock them up. So there's one place they can lock them up, and that's a psychiatric hospital. So I do see that sometimes with conduct disorder, ODD girls. And the driving force is probably we need to protect them from getting pregnant or getting a disease or being trafficked. Anyway, she's there, and she's resistant to any kind of treatment because she's got untreated trauma. She needs help. But she's saying to me, I'm not crazy. And so I sat down with her, and I let the therapist stay in the room, and I said, well, you know what? It kind of dawned on me. I was like, you know what? You're not crazy. I look at your history, and I go, you have an insane childhood, but you are responding in the same manner that probably 70 to 90% of the population, the bell curve, would respond had they had the same experiences growing up that you have had. I would be sitting in your chair right now if I were you as a child. So no, you are not insane. Your childhood was insane, and you are responding in a sane manner, a normal manner, to abnormal circumstances. I think that's an important message for kids because they get labels, they get diagnoses, and they start to feel like there's something wrong with them.
Yeah, I always struggle with the number of diagnoses that some of the kids get, and I think it's all well-meaning professionals just trying to get them help. But at the end of the day, to your point, if you keep getting labeled with this disorder and that disorder and PTSD and all those things, you are going to think, is there something flawed about me versus the circumstance? So I think it's an excellent point. Bill, you want to give us number two?
Sure. Number two is to always keep siblings together. The kids who have just been pulled from their parents, so they've just lost their parents, and they've just gone through enough trauma right there, missing their parents, even though the parents might have done something awful that causing their removal, the kids probably still miss their parents. And then you have siblings, they're in a sibling relationship, and then you separate them. So on top of them missing their parents or their mom or their dad, they're now missing their brother or their sister, and you've taken a child from a home to being completely alone. So the trauma there for that child is significant. So for us, we think that it's key to keep these kids together as best you can and not let placement concerns of an agency determine how kids are placed. Instead, it should be prominent in your mind that these kids need to stay together. They're not going to be with their parents while the case runs its course, but they can be together and support each other and help each other get through what for them is now probably one of the most awful situations they've ever experienced.
Exactly.
Regardless of the allegations.
Absolutely. This one could have been titled Always, Always, Always Keep Siblings Together.
Right.
There are exceptions to it, obviously. You're going to find exceptions because we have kids coming in at such different ages and such different times in the parents' lives sometimes. But all you have to do is imagine yourself taken from your home, put into this strange system to live with strangers, And then picture yourself doing that with a brother and sister with you, whoever your siblings are. And imagine how much less the trauma is, the fear is, everything, if you're moving to that strange foster home with a brother, with a sister, with whoever your siblings are. It minimizes the trauma in half.
And I sometimes feel that we as attorneys will, you know, we're trying to work out something quickly for kids, and we're trying to work with an agency that can have a lot of power. And sometimes we might feel like, you know, we need to do what the agency says. They don't have the relation, they don't have the ability to do what we want, and we need the children to be in a home tonight, in a bed, and not in a hotel. And sometimes I think we go, okay, let's just let them separate them for today. We'll fix it tomorrow, and then we never fix it because the next case comes on the door. Now we've left these three children off into the group, and a month later we're like, oh my God, I never tried to get these kids back together, and no, you know, here they are suffering all this trauma, they're failing in school or whatever. It reminds me of, I just saw a documentary called Three Identical Strangers. I don't know if you guys saw it. It's about the separation of three boys at birth, and they're identical, and they were adopted, and when they discovered each other at age 19 or so, the one of the biggest impacts of this documentary is the pain they felt in having missed each other. First of all, not even knowing they existed. In our circumstance, our kids know the others exist. But just the fact that you could see it, that the pain of not having their sibling with them was so present. And there, they didn't even know they existed. So, I mean, it's so important to make sure that the trauma is lessened in a removal. And this is one way we can correct something while we're trying to work with the parents.
And it's a problem children's attorneys are going to have to fix, usually, because the separation very often happens at removal for placement conveniences like you're talking about. And so children's attorneys is going to be on their, got to be on their radar to be looking to fix it and put them back together quickly.
Well, I think because the urgency for the agency is now gone because they're in homes and if they're doing well. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's so important for the kids' attorney. But the other thing that was coming to mind as you guys were talking was, you know, now that I'm older and I have one parent left, I have a brother. And you realize, you know, a big chunk of your life, that's, you know, your siblings are the longest relationship in your life. And we're, you know, we are focused in the system on kind of the immediate, but that's, if we break that bond, there's, you know, you can't get that back. Or to your point, it's, they missed such a critical window that they regret it, even if they do find each other in the end.
Right. And then you just said something that struck me. Like you said, they're not living together, but they're doing well. Yeah. Well, a lot of times we think, oh, they are doing well. You know, kids recover quickly, but really they're not. Right. If you really think about it, They're gonna make do with what they have, and then we're gonna call that doing well, and then the agency or we are not just gonna do anything about it because it's not the fire anymore.
Right. The agency right. can rest and say the kids are safe.
They're doing well. Yeah,
they're
safe. Tell us.
They're in great homes.
Right.
But if they're not together, then we haven't done our job.
Right. We haven't. Because ultimately it does come down to their sanity or their mental stability, and really it's not there.
Yeah. And there's a best-selling book right now, called Before We Were Yours by Lisa Wingate. I have not read it myself, but one of my attorneys did say to me that she read it and she said, boy, I will think twice before I let siblings get separated on my case for any reason after reading this book. I guess it has to do with the Tennessee Children's Home scandal, and we could do a whole another episode on that, but it drives home the point, I think, even though it's a fictional book with fictional characters, it talks about that pain. And the one character is doing just fine, I think, until she connects and realizes what's been missing. And then the absence is profound when they notice, when they think about it. So you don't notice it as you watch them go through their lives, but it's there.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim, you want to give us number one?
Number one on our five things you should do list, make a promise you can keep. Look, these kids don't trust adults for very good reasons sometimes. And you're walking in as a stranger, dressed in lawyer clothes, and you've got to gain their trust. You can't go promising the moon. You can't promising they'll go home. You can't promise they're going to get adopted. You've got to start with something small that you can accomplish for them, whether it's a visitation with a parent, whatever it is, whether it's just, I'll come back next week and we'll talk about that. And that's a real good practice to get into. I'll come back next week and we'll talk about that. And then show up. And you've just taken a big step with that client in building a rapport and building something that could be a true relationship that can help you actually get inside that kid's mind and represent what they want, what they need. But to do it, you've got to show up. You've got to keep the promise.
This is a building block, right, of representation of kids. This is the building block is trust with kids who don't trust adults. It's our greatest challenge as children's attorneys, I would say, is and what people don't a lot of people who don't do this work don't realize is that counsel and advice is a huge part of the job, is explaining what's happening, getting their input, but you can't even communicate with a kid if they don't trust you. And you have to start early and quickly, because the hard decisions are going to be upon that child and you as their representative very quickly. Within hopefully 12, 15 months, you're going to be making some hard decisions about what to do in the case. And if you don't have a relationship, and you know there are attorneys in this room who have been in that situation of not having had the relationship and having to shoot it on the fly, and it's not the same. So it's really a one brick at a time thing. And boy, there are some kids who are so resistant. Took me 3 years with one girl, but it was one brick at a time, and she wouldn't talk to me for 2 years. Period. Wouldn't say a word to anyone for 2 years. But now she's 19, and she calls me out of the blue to chat with me. So I never thought the day would come, but it really starts with, I will be here next Tuesday to see you again and see what you think. Boom, and you got to show up.
But I think what you're asking attorneys to do is practically impossible, in the sense that maybe it depends on where you work and what your caseload is, but I could see an attorney listening to you going, I can't do that. Well, number one, my social worker does it. And maybe they have a relationship, but two, I'm in court all day. And then you expect me in my low wage to now develop a relationship with my client? I can't do that. I talk to them on the phone. That's enough. Or my social worker goes out and meets them. That's enough. I think you're asking something that is beyond my pay scale, maybe, you know?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with, so let's say you do have 150, right? Well, you don't get them typically all at once. Maybe each new case you get, that's your priority, is establishing, getting that relationship right. You can't, I mean, again, if you have 150, you're not going to be able to do every single thing in every case. But if you don't have some relationship, it's incredibly difficult, not only for the kid to trust you, but to even know what your objectives are. So, I mean, as you look at, aspirationally, I want to have that kind of relationship. Maybe just start with one. The next case you get, do that. And I think when people see the impact of it, once you've established it, then you can do the calls. Maybe you find it takes three visits and you've got the relationship. The kid sees you at court. You touch base. I don't know. I think all of the things that we aspire to are going to bump up against the time and resource struggle. But if you haven't taken the time to do it and you try it, you'll see the benefit and what it adds to the cases. And so start with one. I think that's with anything that we say like that. Start, just pick one and do it.
What I found in meeting kids is that you can, some of them you develop a relationship instantly. It kind of depends on the approach you take in talking with them. Some, I agree with John, can take months or years. And it depends on your persistence and what you need to accomplish. But yeah, I mean, it could just be that one visit that you took the time to have, and now you're on the phone all the time, and so maybe you're texting or email, however you're doing it with them. I agree with you, one step at a time.
Yeah, I think one of the things you said initially when you're saying, you can hear attorneys saying, you expect me to have a relationship with my client? And our answer to that is yes, we do. And that's one of the changes we want to see come about nationwide in these systems, where the children's attorney caseloads and their practices are part of the problem. So going forward, though, do we expect these children's attorneys to have relationships with their clients? Absolutely. I can't think of a lot of attorneys who don't have relationships with their clients, except maybe corporate attorneys. Give them a pass.
Excellent point. Been there, yeah.
Yeah, and no, and to Bill's point, some kids you connect with immediately, and some you don't. But like, and in terms of balancing your work and your calendar, like with the girl, it took me 3 years, 2 years just to get her to speak to me. Part of that relationship building was long periods of space. I'm giving you space. But here comes a judicial review. I'm still here. Oh, you've had two caseworkers. They're gone. You've had two CASAs or guardian ad litems. They're gone. You've changed foster homes. So you've changed schools. Hey, look, who's still here? I mean, you know, I probably would not have been the person she would have chosen to turn to now that she's 19 and might have a landlord problem or wants to buy a used car and doesn't know who to ask for advice. She would not have chosen me, but I'm still here, and there's value just in that. And no, I did not go out to – I did not say, I'll be here next Tuesday and next Tuesday and next Tuesday. So, yeah, that's not what we're saying. But when you first get a case, I think it's good to put that building block down and just keep that one little promise. It doesn't have to be every single week, but just that one little promise. Start with that building block and then keep your word and be constant and show up.
So that wraps up our list of 5 things every children's lawyer should do. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Join us next time. You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.